Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Thank you very much. Happy Mother's Day for all you mothers there. I'm not a mother, as I hope you can tell. But I did remember to send the card, which I was very happy about. I'm sure you think that's the least I could do, but trust me. Remembering was an achievement. It's great to be back here at the Mermaid. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Joel. As Liam said, I attend the East Service, but you can probably tell I'm slowly becoming a walking East London cliche. I coach some of the Connect groups out there. During the week, I'm a graphic designer. I work for the Telegraph newspaper, and you may or may not know that I recently got engaged. So I'm currently, thank you very much, thank you. Evenings and weekends, I'm now currently planning a wedding, which has been wonderfully stress-free. Speaking of which, I'd just like to take this moment to apologise in advance, as most of the stories and analogies that I'll be sharing involve my fiancée, Dee. And I tried really hard to think of some others, but since we started planning this wedding, I haven't been able to get her lovely voice out of my head. Don't worry, they get better. So we're nearly at the end of our sermon series on Joshua. We've heard about the battles, the spies, the armies, and the faithfulness of Joshua to get the Israelites to where they are now. The battles had been won, the land had been divided, and Israel would no longer be living in tents days at a time. They were no longer walking in the wilderness. For the first time ever, they had a permanent home. And what we'll be looking at today is Joshua, this mighty leader, handing over the baton to the leaders that would succeed him and saying his parting words. And rarely does someone get such an opportunity for such a powerful and meaningful transition as this. And arguably, this is the most important speech of Joshua's life, because it's his opportunity to get across what he thinks is the key thing for the future of Israel. And all of the future leaders would have been all ears. And in our society today, we see succession happening all the time, where one leader is brought in to replace another, to varying degrees of success. And occasionally you hear of an organization or a sports team whose success increases exponentially after a replaced leader or an influential leader is replaced. And probably the best example of this today is in football, where under the management of Claudio Ranieri, Leicester City are miraculously top of the Premier League when this time last year they only just avoided relegation. But of course it won't last, and Arsenal will eventually rise up and win the league. They've all, you know, please. But often when, unfortunately, when a successful and influential leader is replaced and the succession goes badly, the failure is often very public and very painful. So here's a few examples of some of those very public failures. George V, he was replaced by his son, Edward VIII, who abdicated after a few months after wanting to marry Wallis Simpson, who was a divorcee, and that wasn't allowed at that time. And we have Alex Ferguson, who was, an incredibly successful manager at Man United, won numerous titles over many, many years. The chosen one to replace him was David Moyes, who hilariously just lasted 7 months before he was sacked. And if there are any Americans in the room here today, I'm sure you'll be watching along with the rest of the world in fascination as to the identity of the person that's going to replace this man. And that's all I'm going to say. But succession happens everywhere, and it is vitally important. In fact, Alistair Campbell recently wrote an article in The Guardian saying that some of the recent failings of Man United and Labour at the last election were down to poorly handled succession after Alex Ferguson and Tony Blair. And here in this passage is the moment where we come to Joshua's succession. And he's handing over to the new leaders of Israel. So it's his moment to get it right and to get across what he believes to be the most important thing for the future of Israel. So what did he say? What message was so important to Joshua that it would be the words that he passes on to those new leaders? And what did he want his legacy as a leader to be? And how can we use the words of an old leader thousands of years ago? How can we use those words to help us in our lives now in a very different society and culture? So let's read the passage. And it's a little bit long, but the words will be on the screen behind so you can follow along. So it's Joshua 23. After a long time had passed and the Lord had given rest from all the enemies around them, Joshua, by then a very old man, summoned all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges and officials, and said to them, "I am very old. You yourselves have seen everything the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. It was the Lord your God who fought for you. Remember how I've allotted as an inheritance for your tribes all the land of the nations that remain, the nations I conquered, between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea in the west. The Lord your God himself will push them out for your sake. He will drive them out before you, and you will take possession of their land as the Lord your God promised you. Be very strong. Be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the right or to the left. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but you are to hold fast to the Lord your God as you have until now. The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000 because the Lord your God fights for you just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. But if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. Instead, they will become snares and traps for you, whips on your backs and thorns in your eyes until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. Now I am about to go the way of all the earth. You know with all your heart and soul that not one of all the good promises the Lord your God gave you has failed. Every promise has been fulfilled, not one has failed. But just as all the good things the Lord your God has promised you have come to you, so he will bring on you all the evil things he has threatened, until the Lord your God has destroyed you from this good land he has given you. If you violate the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, the Lord's anger will burn against you, and you will quickly perish from the good land he has given you. It's rare to see a leader in his legacy-defining speech talk so little about himself. And perhaps if you're like me, one of the things you'd be concerned about is what you achieved and that people would remember what you had done and the legacy that you had left. And I found it quite funny that one of the things one of the only things he states about himself is that he's very old. It's actually the first thing he says, which like it wasn't obvious enough. And it's like if I came up here and said, you know, I'm early to mid-20s. Oh, you didn't laugh. You think that's true? Great. Or, you know, if Dave Stroud came on the stage and said that he was... I probably shouldn't finish that sentence. I'll probably get in trouble. He's not here, but there we are. But you often hear particularly politicians talk about their own legacy and what they achieved in the time they were in leadership. But for Joshua, he seems to be less concerned about what he did and more concerned about what God had done and what he will do in the future. Joshua's legacy was that it was not about Joshua. It was not about the battles that he had won for the Israelites. And it was not that the new Israelite leaders should emulate him, although that certainly wouldn't have hurt. The one thing that permeates not only this speech, but Joshua's whole life, is that he loves God and wants Israel to do the same. And it's as simple as that. He wants his defining message to be this: love God. And to make that point, Joshua focuses on two extremes, on two ends of the spectrum. And the first is a warning. It's the reasons why the Israelites shouldn't be influenced by the nations around them by worshipping idols. And when we hear the word idol, many of us think that's quite an old-fashioned term, and it feels like it's something that's a bit outdated and doesn't really affect us today. But actually, an idol is anything that becomes an object of our worship, anything that we give time and or undue time and energy to. So the first extreme is that warning. And the second is the petition to love God and stay faithful to him. But the way Joshua structures his farewell speech, I find really, really interesting, because he keeps focusing on the warning again and again and again. Instead of making his point quickly about how worshipping idols is bad and then moving on to saying how good God is and he's the only one that's completely worthy of our worship and our praise, he keeps coming back to the warning. So, for example, in verses 7 and 8, he warns them not to associate with those nations or bow down to their gods. He then focuses on God and all the things that he's done for them. But then again in 12 and 13, he warns the Israelites about what will happen if they're influenced by their neighbours. And even his last remarks are focused on the warning. And it's in verses 15 and 16 where he really hammers it home. If you turn away from God, bad stuff is going to happen. If you turn away from him, he will turn away from you. And most of my generation, or the millennials as we're known, we were recently described as the most selfish generation, which was wonderfully uplifting. We like to be inspired. We like handwritten quotes over a sunset on our Instagram feed. Next slide. Yeah, like this. Lovely. Or aerial shots of the coffee and croissant our friends had for breakfast. Just look at them. Aren't they lovely? Makes you a little bit sick. But we don't want negativity. We want inspiration. But Joshua clearly didn't go on Instagram. He was all negativity and no sunsets. But I think that there's a very important reason for that, and we'll look into that in a bit more detail later. But when I was talking about this with Dee, how Joshua structures his speech, she said that it reminded her of the negative sandwich. Now, I had no idea what the negative sandwich was. And she then replies to say that it's when you hide a negative point you really want to make by sandwiching it between two positives. So, for example, she might say, Joel, that T-shirt looks great on you. It could be a little looser, but the colour really brings out your eyes. Now, my response to that would be, oh, thanks, Dee. I knew it brought the colour out of my eyes. I knew as soon as I bought it. Thank you so much. But then I dwell and contemplate on the compliment and start to think, well, maybe it is a little bit tight. But why is that? I mean, it was fine when I bought it. And it can't be the T-shirt's fault. Maybe it's shrunk in the wash, or maybe it's me. Have I put on weight? I've put on weight. I'm hideous. I need to go for a run immediately. And there we have the negative sandwich, and thus Dee's point is made. And I dread to think how many major life decisions I've made based on the negative sandwich. But seriously, Dee's a great fiancée. She could be a bit more encouraging, but I can't wait to get married to her. Good. But Joshua, he isn't using the negative sandwich technique. He doesn't want to hide it away in and amongst compliments. Because if at the root of what Joshua was desperate to leave with the Israelites was simply to love God, and if he thought that by focusing on the warning was what those leaders needed at that time, then it would have been wrong of him not to have done that. From this passage and the context of Joshua 23, I think there are three pitfalls to this warning that Joshua would have been desperate for the new leaders to avoid, things that hinder this love for God that he was so keen for them to focus on. And the first one is this: unhelpful influence. Joshua was concerned that the Israelites would be influenced by the people that remain in the land they now possess. And there are numerous verses in this passage that are essentially words to that effect, and there's one on the board there. And Joshua was concerned that the worshipping of idols that the nations around them did would influence the Israelites' own worship. And that kind of thing can happen to all of us. We are all influenced by the people around us, and what is important to them can become important to us just because of their influence on us, whether good or bad. For example, if I spend all my time with Liam, chances are some of Liam's character is going to have an impact on me. I'll see firsthand how he lives his life, how he deals with conflict, how he treats his family, and I'll see what's important to him, and it will help shape me and influence who I am. Or as Dee spends more and more time with me, maybe she'll realise that football really is a force for good in this world, and her eyes will be opened and she'll love it for herself. That's how marriage works, isn't it? Yeah? Good. Yeah. That's a joke. We are all influenced by the people we spend most of our time with. And I think that's a real challenge for us. Who are we spending most of our time with? What kind of influence are they on you? And are they bringing you closer to God or further away? Do they bring the best out in you? And what kind of influence are you on them? And this is a real challenge as it affects most of our life. What kind of career we'll get, the kind of person we'll date or marry, the places that we'll live. They will all bring us into situations where we'll be in a position to influence and be influenced by others. And we must be aware of that, just as Joshua was making this so clear to the new leaders of Israel. But what I'm not saying is that we need to shut the doors and lock them up and keep ourselves locked away from the big bad world outside. Of course not. We want to go out and we want to love people and see our city changed. But it says in 1 Corinthians that bad company corrupts good character. And it can be a bit like when you put a frog in water and slowly turn up the heat. The frog will not even realise that it's slowly boiling. And it can be the same with us. We need to make sure that the company we keep is not corrupting our own character, particularly when we don't realise it. Joshua didn't want anyone or anything getting in the way of the Israelites' love for God. And for us, are there people in our lives that are pulling us away from him rather than pointing us to him? And the second warning, I think, that is more implicit in this passage is avoiding pride. And when you look at the context of both the recent past of the Israelites and the situation that Joshua was leaving them in at that time, most of the Israelites, if not all of them, would have known God's blessing and faithfulness. When you've seen walls collapse from a great city, when you've walked around it a few times, or when you see water clear out the way as you cross a great river, or when you've succeeded on a mission that's looked completely impossible at the start, maybe you're going to start thinking you can do no wrong. Perhaps pride can edge its way in. And sometimes when we're used to God's blessing and are perhaps more oblivious to some of the challenges that can come into our lives, sometimes we need a bit of a wake-up call. sometimes pride can take over and we need a bit of reminding as to where we really stand. And I remember one evening when myself, Dee, and Dee's parents were going to see the Nutcracker on Ice, which is beautiful, you must see it. And Dee and I just got engaged, so I was trying really, really hard to impress, to make sure Dee's parents knew that they hadn't made a mistake in giving me their blessing to ask Dee to marry me. So I slicked back my hair, had a shave, put on my best shirt. You know, I was out to impress, and I looked and felt like $1 million, I must say. And I was on my own at this point, and I strutted outside of out of South Kensington Station, feeling and looking great, and I was greeted by the sound of laughing children running around, having the time of their lives, throwing fizzy drinks over each other. And then it happened. I was caught in the crossfire, and I was hit right in the chest. And as I stared down at my Pepsi-stained shirt, all the rage bubbled up inside of me. And I took one look at that already horrified child, and by child I mean about 15, not like 4, just in case you judge me even more than you're about to. And all of the Christian meekness left my body as fast as that Pepsi had left the can. And I can't remember exactly what I said. All I remember is that it started with the words, "Oi, you." This will be the last time I'm on this stage, probably. And once I'd finished my rant and began to walk away, I felt like the toughest man going to see the Nutcracker on Ice that night. And perhaps that's how the Israelites felt. After winning the battles they had won, I'm sure they felt tough and strong, and perhaps some of the pride was seeping its way into the Israelite camp. But unfortunately, that's not the end of my story. To my horror, I then feel a slight tapping on my shoulder and the words that I will never forget. "Joel, are you okay?" And as I turned around, there was Mr. and Mrs. Atkins looking right at me, who had witnessed the whole thing. And this was the night I was supposed to blow them away with my wit, my charm, and my rugged good looks. And I just shouted at a child. It was quite possibly the most terrifying experience of my life, and I was praying that they hadn't heard what I just said. But I would have left that moment feeling self-righteous, proud, and arrogant, but instead I felt stupid, regretful, and embarrassed. I had Mr. and Mrs. Atkins to remove my pride, but Israel had Joshua. And as we've read through the book of Joshua, it is absolutely clear that God was with them. And maybe, just maybe, some of the Israelites took that for granted. And Joshua's warning comes to make sure they focus on who is important. And if we want to love God, there must be no place for pride. And maybe Joshua is using this opportunity to warn the new leaders of the consequences of complacency, where pride, arguably the most dangerous of vices, can edge its way in. And if the very essence of pride is to love yourself over everything and everyone else, then it's going to stand in the way of you loving God, the very thing that Joshua is desperate for the Israelites to do. I think there's another reason why Joshua is so keen to warn the Israelites. At this point in the story, the people, they were relatively safe as you can be in that situation. They could build homes and businesses and cities. They had achieved so much. And everything that they'd been told growing up about being God's chosen people and the promised land, it was finally here, and they had their home. And now that the wars were over, there was a different type of battleground, and I've called it the danger of normality. Perhaps Joshua was so persistent because he knew that in the normality of daily life, in the mundaneness and the regularity and the routine, where the danger of war has gone and the dust has settled, that is where sin can get a grip. When you're outnumbered 1,000 to 1, fighting for what will be your home, you need God in those moments, and you're going to cry out to him. But when all it seems you do is wake up, work, eat, sleep, wake up, work, eat, sleep, wake up, work, eat, sleep. In those situations, maybe we forget God. And that is where we're most vulnerable to sin. And in the day-to-day of normal life, I can so easily coast. I can drift from showing God that I love him and I want to follow him and be more like him for the simple reason, whether subconsciously or not, I forget him because I'm not facing an army. I'll go on Facebook instead of reading my Bible, or I'll chat on WhatsApp instead of praying to God. And Joshua was warning the people because the battles had been won, and now was the time to face a different challenge, and it's one that we all face. And when it comes to our heart and soul, normality can be one of the most dangerous things that we face. We can let our guard down. We can see what other people are doing and want some of that for ourselves. And for the Israelites, it was worshipping the idols of the people around them. But for us, maybe it's the love of money or the relentless pursuit of a career that affects our relationships with others. Or perhaps it's to drink a little bit too much every weekend, promising that we'll stop next time. Maybe those things are our idols. And they may not be as obvious as the idols in the time of Joshua, but they can be just as dangerous. And what we see from this passage is that Joshua was consumed with the state of the Israelites' hearts and minds and their faithfulness to and love for God. And perhaps Joshua knew that when the battles were over, that is when the temptation to look to other things for your meaning, for your worth and your identity comes into play. And this is why I believe Joshua is so relentless in his warning. And his final moment, his final words, the crescendo moment, couldn't be any more clear. If you violate the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, the Lord's anger will burn against you and you'll quickly perish from the good land he has given. And that's it. Joshua sits down. It's not quite the standing ovation Hollywood ending you might expect at such a key moment. You can almost hear the awkward silence as he finishes his speech. But I think Joshua focused on the warning here for a reason. He's urging them to have faith in God because he is faithful to his word, both in grace, which is what they would have had plenty of experience in, but also in judgment. And he's warning them of what the consequences of their decisions could be. And perhaps the Israelites needed a bit of negativity at this point. And besides, if some negativity is what they needed to stay faithful to God, then why not use that? Don't worship idols, be wary of pride and the unhelpful influences. And in normal, ordinary life, be careful not to forget God, but instead love him. And there's another side to Joshua's farewell, the other end of the spectrum. And it's the reasons to love God as opposed to the reasons not to worship idols. And when we look at verses 10 and 11, I think this essentially says everything that we need to hear. And it's these two verses that have been a real encouragement to me. Joshua says this: "One of you routs or defeats 1,000, because the Lord your God fights for you just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God." Just one Israelite is able to take down 1,000 enemies, and I appreciate there's probably some hyperbole there, simply because God was with them and he fights for them. But I love Joshua's advice in this verse. If we're to defeat 1,000, Joshua's advice is not to build great defences or to practice your fighting skills or to keep your sword sharp. It's simply to love God. Even when the Israelites were outnumbered 1,000 to 1, Joshua's only request of them was to love God because he does the fighting for them and through them. And in the same way, when we face battles in our own life, when it feels like it's just you versus 1,000, when it feels like to defeat what you're going through would be impossible, the thing we must all do is love God, and that is it. It's the foundation of everything, and everything else builds on that. And God will fight for us just as he did with the Israelites. And I'm certain that there are people in this room right now who some of those battles will be coming to your mind right now. You feel like what you're going through is like facing 1,000. And I don't think I even need to give examples because, as I said, they'll be coming to your mind right now. I just want to encourage you that even in those toughest of times, that loving and trusting in God is the best thing that we can do, because he's fighting for you even now, even if the battle is going on in your heart and your mind. So Joshua fights for us. Sorry, God fights for us just as he promised. So we should love him. And Joshua, in essence, is saying to the Israelites in his farewell speech that the one thing God requires above all other things is our love, not our deeds or our sacrifice or our money. And he does not want to see our love given away cheaply to idols that will never satisfy us. He wants our love. And that is what Joshua's parting words are to the Israelites: choose God over everything and anything else. Love him. And the main way that Joshua does that is to appeal to the Israelites' memory. Joshua is saying that the Israelites must remember all the good stuff that God has done, how he defeated armies for you, how he kept his promises. Remember. Remember what God has done, and remember how you have remained faithful to him. And in verse 3, he says, for example, "You yourselves have seen." He's appealing to their memory to confirm all that God has done. And he's essentially saying, you almost don't even need me to remind you. All you need to do is look back and remember. And for the Israelites, it was remembering physical battles. But for us, it is a spiritual battle. And what we must remember is the cross and Jesus. Joshua appeals to the memory of the Israelites to events that they would have experienced themselves, essentially using the logic of evidence as a basis for faith. And just in the same way, we can do that too. And Andy touched on this a few weeks ago. But there are good and reasonable explanations that can lead us to the conclusion that, first of all, Jesus existed, and every serious historian would agree on that point. But also that he was who he said he was. And if you want to look into the historical evidence for Jesus in a bit more detail, then Lee Strobel's The Case for Christ is a really good starting point and starts to answer and look into some of those questions that you may have. But remembering and memory is a hugely powerful tool in keeping us in love with God. Slightly cheesy example. During World War II, there was a soldier named John Blanchard, and he was in the library in Florida, and he was reading a book that had loads of notes scribbled in the margins. And he quickly became more interested and captivated by the notes as opposed to the story itself. And he discovered from the front of the book that the notes had been written by someone called Hollis Maynell. And with a lot of time and effort, he tracked down her address. They didn't have Tinder or Facebook in those days. And they found out that she lived in New York, and he wrote to her, inviting her to write back. And the next day, he was shipped overseas to fight in Europe. And over the next year or so, they had written back and forth, and slowly this soldier fell deeply in love with Hollis Maynell. He had never met her or seen what she'd looked like, and he even asked her to send a photo, but she refused, saying that if you really loved me, it wouldn't matter what I looked like. And when he finally returned from Europe, they agreed to meet in Grand Central Station. And she told him that she'd be wearing a red rose on her lapel. So he arrived at the station looking for the girl he loved but had never seen. And as he was looking around, he noticed a young woman coming towards him, and she was stunningly beautiful and was wearing a green suit. And he almost subconsciously made his way over to her, forgetting that she wasn't wearing the red rose. And then he saw Hollis Maynell, and she was standing almost directly behind this girl. She was a lot older than him, not looking particularly nervous or excited that she was about to meet the man that she'd loved for the first time. And he was torn in two. And then he remembered. He remembered the letters that had sustained him during the war, of the love that he had felt. And he let the girl in the green suit pass by and made his way over to Hollis Maynell. The memory of those letters and love that he felt as a result helped him at that moment. And memory is a hugely powerful tool in keeping us in love with God. A love that is not just an emotion or a feeling, but a love that is strong and enduring. And when John Blanchard approached Hollis Maynell, he said this: "I'm Lieutenant John Blanchard, and you must be Miss Maynell. I am so glad you could meet me. May I take you to dinner?" And she replied, "I don't know what this is about, son, but the young lady in the green suit who just went by begged me to wear this rose on my coat. She said if you were to ask me out to dinner, I should tell you that she is waiting for you in the big restaurant across the street. She said it was some kind of test." Bit harsh, but yeah. The memory of those letters helped John Blanchard make the right choice. And he found a love and a beauty that was greater than he could have hoped for. And the memory of what Jesus did for us on the cross can sustain us. And we will find a love and a beauty there that is greater and more fulfilling than we could imagine. All of the sin, the pride, the selfishness, the despair, the loneliness that was mine became his, and it died with him on the cross. And when we remember that, and when I remember that, it draws me to him. It cultivates love for him. And when I've had doubts or questions or felt far away from God, I've tried to cut out everything else and just looked to Jesus. And all the questions that you may have, or the hurts that you may have suffered, look to Jesus. Read about him, think about him, talk to him and see what happens. And just as Joshua was saying to the Israelites to remember what God has done, we need to remember what Jesus did for us. And as I've done this in my own life, I've seen two things happen. The first is my own complete sense of helplessness, my own flaws and my own failings. And you might ask, why on earth would I want to do that? And I don't mean that I'm knocking myself down or lowering my self-esteem every time I think about Jesus. Guilt is not a feeling that he'd want us to dwell upon. What happens is that in spite of all of those things, all of those failures and mistakes, is the realization that Jesus still loves me and he died for me so that I could live. And he fought for me and he fought for you. And as a result, it's not difficult to become more and more captivated by Jesus. Everything is about him and who he is. And I loved what Rich said earlier in the worship. It's all about Jesus. If you want to defeat what feels like 1,000, love Jesus. If you want to defeat pride, then love Jesus. If you want to defeat your idols, love Jesus. He's already defeated them, and all he asks for in return is our love. So the Israelites, they have a choice. Joshua gives them a choice. The question for the generation following Joshua was this: who will you love? Will you look to the idols of the people around you? Or will you love the true and living God? It's up to you. And this question that Joshua asks is true of every one of us today, whether you follow Jesus or not. What are you putting your faith in? What or who do you love? And I'm a bit of an introvert. So situations like this where I stand in front of lots of people, they don't come as naturally to me as they do to others. And when I came to this point about writing, who am I putting my faith in? I had this deep conviction about where a lot of my own insecurities and worries and anxieties come from doing this kind of thing. Because I'm afraid of messing up, of looking stupid, and of people thinking less of me. I've actually had dreams where I've come up on the stage and had nothing to say. It's been horrible. And I realized that my motive for working as hard as I could to give a good talk was that I wanted people to like me rather than love God. And my idol had become my own need of affirmation. And I was putting my faith in myself rather than in him. What are you putting your faith in? What or who are you living for? Who do you love? And when we recognize some of the idols in our lives, the solution is not to try really, really hard not to love them. The solution is to replace that love with a love that is bigger, that is greater, and ever more satisfying. And when Jesus was asked in Matthew 22 what the greatest commandment was, he said this: love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. With all our heart, because it must come from the inside. It cannot be on the surface. With all our soul, because it must affect our whole being. And with all our mind, because it must affect how we think, what we say, and what we do. Would you mind standing to your feet? And the worship team are going to come back up and lead us in a song in a moment. But for some of us, there may be some idols that have sprung up in your own life. You may not be a follower of Jesus, but you know there's an idol in your life that you just can't shift, however hard you try. I'd encourage you to talk with someone at the end or pray that God will cultivate a love for him that will make your idol seem weak and unfulfilling. And I know that for some of us, what we're going through right now feels like it's us versus 1,000. I just want you to know there's an opportunity for you to receive prayer as well. And for those of us who are at the start of our journey in exploring faith, maybe the next step is as simple as buying Lee Strobel's book and weighing up the evidence for yourself. Maybe it's speaking with someone you trust and asking them to pray for you. Or maybe you are ready. You may not have all the answers you thought you needed, but you're ready to follow Jesus and all that he has for you. And there'll be an opportunity for all of that today, and the prayer team will come to the front during this song. But I'd encourage you that if anything that I've tried to talk about today has stirred your heart, then don't let this opportunity pass you by. Come forward to receive prayer or just to talk, and they'd be delighted to do that. But I'm going to pray, and then the band will lead us. God, thank you that you fight for us, every single one of us, and that you love us, Lord. I pray that we leave this place a little closer to you, a little more in love with you. Teach us to rely on you in the tough times, in the boring times, and in the good times, God. Help us to remember all that you did for us on the cross. Help us to remember how much you love us. Yeah, thank you, Lord Jesus. Amen.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.